Remember when I got caught stealing all those watches from Sears? Well, that's nothing because you have a gambling problem. And remember when I let that escaped lunatic in the house because he was dressed like Santa Claus? Well, you have a gambling problem.
Oh, when you forgive someone, you can't throw it back at them like that.
Let's go. Coming to you from the basement of the basement of WCPT 820 in Chicago, it is the Sports Cubicle. Where the inmates run the asylum and the boss is going to be mad at us because we are working overtime to cover sports for you. Big stories this week, like Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, who's in some hot water right now, Ipe Mitsuzara, charged this week with bank fraud. Also, we talked to Ken Smoller, who wrote the book Last Comiskey that'll be coming out later this month. And you remember me talking about what's going to happen to the Northwestern football team in 2024? Where are they going to play? Well, we got a little bit of an answer this week. We're going to talk about that, as well as where are the Arizona Coyotes going to be playing next year? All that and more on the Sports Cubicle coming up. Mercado, take it away.
We keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado. I am joined by the one, the only, the great Paul Shavari. And Paulie, this news story, it's been a news-heavy edition of the Sports Cubicle. And this is coming down the newswire. This is from the United States Attorney's Office, Central District of California. Japanese language translator charged in complaint with illegally transferring more than $16 million from baseball players' accounts. A Japanese language translator was charged today via federal criminal complaints with unlawfully transferring more than $16 million from Major League Baseball players' bank account without the player's knowledge or permission, to pay off his own substantial gambling debts occurred with an illegal bookmaking operation. Ipe Mizuhara, 39, of Newport Beach, as of this article, is charged with bank fraud, a felony offense that carries a statutory maximum sentence of 30 years in federal prison. Mizuhara is expected to appear in the United States District in downtown Los Angeles for his initial appearance in the near future. According to an affidavit, with the complaint from November 2021 to January 2024, Mizuhara wired more than $16 million in unauthorized transfers from a checking account belonging to an MLB player identified in the affidavit as Victim A. We know him as the unicorn Shohei Ohtani, who in fact is MLB star Shohei Ohtani. The transfers from the bank account allegedly were made from the devices and IP addresses associated with Mizuhara, who served as Ohtani's translator and de facto manager. And it also, the entire affidavit, the press release also mentions that in 2008 that Mizuhara took Shohei Ohtani to open up all his bank accounts in Arizona in 2018, and he was part of that entire process. So that is what we know now. And then there's even leaked text messages of Mizuhara saying that he's bad at this gambling thing, and I'll get the exact quotes in a little bit as we keep going on in this conversation so I don't just pull it out of thin air. But this is getting messy. This is a sad story, Paulie, and for right now, as of this instance, taking Shohei out of this, because MLB is still going to do their investigation. That's not what the federal government's looking into. They're looking at illegal book operations, illegal gambling, but they're also talking about bank fraud and wire transfer illegally doing all this. So this is a big deal. So Paul, first thing I want to get your thoughts on, when you heard the official affidavit, what's going to be charged, what's happening, what were your initial thoughts now that we have a little bit more clarity of what the federal government's looking at?
I think I was thinking what everyone else is thinking is, how could Shohei not know about this? And I know that part of this investigation is showing that there were no text messages about gambling between Shohei and Ipe. And I don't know. I mean, you know, we're not part of the investigation, so who am I to say that, you know, this smells funny, or I don't think that's the truth, or it's an ongoing investigation, and Shohei's not on trial, so I don't know how thorough of an investigation to his doings there's going to be. But we do know that his interpreter is definitely guilty of, you know, we have evidence that he was communicating with illegal bookies. We have evidence that he placed bets. We have evidence that he's, what was it, $40 million in debt or something ridiculous like that. We have evidence that he transferred $16 million out of Shohei's bank account. So I guess we need a thorough understanding of how limited Shohei's involvement was. I think that's ideally the how this affects you, me, baseball fans, sports fans, all around the world, is just please let us know that you've looked up and down, turned over every rock, and you found out that Shohei didn't know about any of this happening. The hard thing is that this is his friend, and you would feel that there'd be kind of a close confidence, you know, I guess, you know, the, how was he able to open these bank accounts with Shohei? Okay. He's his interpreter. How was he able to extract the money? And that's where I don't know, where did he have access to passwords? Did he have, you know, what involvement did the interpreter have, you know, that Shohei Ohtani gave him, where maybe this guy could go behind Shohei's back and do this sort of stuff. So I think there's a lot of questions that need to be answered. I can understand the skepticism behind, you know, clearing Shohei's name. But it sounds like the feds don't have any case against Shohei Ohtani, but they do have a huge case against his interpreter.
So it is a 37-page complaint. That is how in detail, that is how much information is in this entire, and this, now this information is coming from the Ringer, and this also from the Ringer, that 19,000 bets were made in this time period. And I think that's important to bring up, because beyond just a friendship now broken, because you have to be he's taking advantage of Shohei. Let's say this is all on board and everything is what it seems to be as of this day, right? That means somebody took advantage of a friend. Somebody took advantage of somebody who's so dedicated in their craft. They take what they believe and they do so personally, and they're so invested in it that they entrusted you in the way to help them maintain their life, to get them set up in a new country, took advantage of that. But if you're doing that, it's one thing if your friend loses $20 every once in a while and, you know, ask you to borrow to buy him lunch that day. But when you're talking about millions of dollars and you having to do what he had to do in order to change phone numbers and where money is transferred to and having access, you know how hard it is to change your Amazon password, let alone bank account information? That's how much input he had in this. That goes to show his addiction level. Musahara, it's bad. Like, it's sad. It's sad a friendship was lost. But in a world where we are so gambling focused now, fantasy sports, March Madness brackets, any single time an over or under, a prop bet, the NFL season, we have organizations, leagues, broadcast partners that are sponsored by big time gambling websites. And somebody now with an addiction could put a huge, potentially could have put a huge black eye in an entire sport. And I think that's something that we talk about, but we really can't comprehend this new melding world, universes of gambling, legal gambling, sports gambling, and entrusting individuals, not just players, not just coaches, not just front office, but auxiliary people surrounding the team and organizations. I think that's something that maybe the big time owners, corporations may have seen coming, but I don't know if fandom, the everyday fan, knew this was going to be the outcome of that.
Well, this is a little different since it's illegal gambling. Mm. You know, what if it was a legal website? I suppose it would be quicker to see how much money is being transferred through. And I suppose the red flags that would exist when you see Shohei Ohtani's bank account and routing information being sent to DraftKings or, you know, whatever, you know, betting site du jour. But I don't know. I think it definitely peels back a layer that shows that there still is this seedy underworld of illegal gambling. Not that I didn't think it didn't exist anymore, but the fact that it's just so closely connected to professional sports. And honestly, I think it's never, there's always going to be, regardless of how cut and dry the information is, and that, you know, we know the players at stake, we know who's, you know, going to prison, who committed crimes, who didn't. It's always going to be a stain on Shohei Ohtani and the game of baseball. And of course, you know, I think we talked about this in the last time that we talked about this, that this is the most MLB thing to happen. Like, right on opening day, their superstar gets involved in gambling. And it's like, you know, it doesn't matter what generation, what era, you know, like, you know, our grandparents that rooted for Pete Rose, their grandparents that rooted for Shoeless Joe, you know, who's going to be our grandkids that, you know, say it ain't so, Shohei, you know, in 20, 30 years.
And you know it's coming because, like you said, it's Major League Baseball. That is ingrained in the sport. And I am so glad you brought up Pete Rose. As we are breaking down this news of Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, now the charges are coming in. We know what he is facing. We are breaking it down here on the Sports Cubicle. He's Paul Shavari. I'm Mike Mercado. I want to bring up Pete Rose. I think this is something, again, fandom. I think it's a societal thing, right, where we like to compare things and we like to weigh them in the same weight of justice and try to make everything just clear and cut the same. And you hear people now defending Pete Rose, saying because of all these networks working together with these betting sites and this story potentially with Shohei Ohtani, that Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. He should be forgiven, so on and so forth. I think if your argument is because of gambling now being legal and part of the sports world, or because of what's going on with Shohei, I think you're wrong. I think if you're saying Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame because it's a museum and you should tell the entire story, I think you're right. Pete Rose should be in the Hall of Fame. You can bring him into the Hall of Fame. But to tell me that it's okay now to forgive him because of DraftKings, FanDuel, Bet Rivers, Circus Sports, and the Shohei Ohtani is disingenuous. It's a strongman conversation because it is not based on reality. He did his crime. He did break the rules you're not supposed to do. He bet on baseball, period. He did. Not an interpreter, not a third person, not some shady guy on the side. He did. Pete Rose. So if you want to say Pete Rose deserves to be in the museum that is known as the Baseball Hall of Fame, God bless you. I agree. This isn't the argument to use for that case.
Well, and it's a flawed argument anyway, because we can't prove that Shohei Ohtani or his interpreter even bet on baseball.
Bingo.
We do know for a fact that Pete Rose bet on baseball, and we do know for a fact that he bet on games that the Cincinnati Reds played in while he was managing the team. And regardless of the fact that he didn't bet against the Reds, presumably, but even if he didn't, that's still a conflict of interest. That's the whole point of this thing. You know, he can tax his bullpen just to win a meaningless game in May, you know, versus, well, that might have helped us down the stretch for a pennant run instead of blowing the guy's arm out early. But that's neither here nor there. And, you know, and as far as Pete Rose, you know my feelings on it. You know, the guy didn't even start telling the truth until he conveniently needed to sell a book. So, you know, does he deserve to be a Hall of Famer? Does he deserve, while he's above the ground, to call himself a Hall of Famer? I don't care what happens to him posthumously. If you want to add him to the Hall of Fame after he's long gone and let his kids or his grandkids benefit off of that, that's fine by me. But Pete Rose cannot, absolutely under no circumstances, be a Hall of Famer or be eligible to be involved with Major League Baseball, especially in a day and age where gambling is legal. You know, the guy had no contrition. You know, he moved to Las Vegas. He's, you know, allegedly involving himself in bets after his baseball career anyway, as he's allowed to as a free citizen that's ineligible for baseball. But you would have to, in order for the Pete Rose argument to be valid, you need to prove that there are current baseball players betting on the sport and being protected. And you can't prove that with Shohei right now. It's the court of public opinion. And you know what? I found, in my opinion, a lot of Pete Rose defenders are dumb. They're very dumb people. So having this sort of argument with them is already going to be a loss for both parties at the first clause of the argument.
God bless you, Paulie. So I'm with you. Like, I am one that believes all Hall of Fames are museums. And personally, I have a lot of beef with the Baseball Writers of America. I do. I do think there's a huge pretentiousness in that group of people, more than almost any other voters of Hall of Famers, that they seem to be the ones that are the ultimate gatekeepers. Different conversation you and I can have All-Star Weekend, but this is what I mean, though. Your argument for not allowing Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame is a genuine one. And then there are people who have genuine arguments of why he should be. I can listen to both, respect both, understand both. I am not accepting one after today based on what's happening right now, or because you can draft, you can do anything you want on DraftKings or FanDuel. And I will say this to the league. You make enough money. We have TV deals coming up. Your players should be allowed. LeBron should be able to bet on the Dallas Cowboys versus the Cleveland Browns. You have enough money. to create your own separate apps, different servers that these players can safely and monitor what they are doing. If they're going to gamble on their own sports, they're not going to do it above board anyway. So that's not what your worry should be. Your worry should be, hey, if we're going to facilitate this to our fans, we should do it safely for our players, and we'll make a way to make it profitable for us, like you always have to make these things happen, but to also avoid black guys. There's only one black guy the NFL has beyond gambling, and it's that somebody dying on the field. Even then, people will still come and watch that sport. You start going to the integrity of these games, that is the death of a sport. And right now, you could get ahead of it. And this is a great time for it. So this is why I wanted to really bring this conversation, because it's about gambling addiction. It's about friendship. It's about baseball. It's about culture. It's about the future of these industries, the industry you and I are in, and Devin in media. So I thought this was a great point for us to really break down this entire situation beyond just, did you hear what happened to Shohei?
Yeah, and I don't know, to follow up your point about LeBron should be allowed to bet. I mean, you picked basketball and that, or football, and that's a safe bet for a basketball player. But let's keep in mind the conflict of if bet on, let's say, baseball, LeBron James. He's part owner of a baseball team. So, I mean, you know, that's rough, you know, that's a rough thing. That's unique to one individual there. Not everybody in the league owns other professional sports franchises, but it's got to be up to each individual union. I don't like the fact, you know, why are these guys being paid absurd amounts of money if they absolutely need to gamble in their free time? What's the incentive for them to gamble? If it's to make more money, if it's to make the game more fun, why are they even an athlete to begin with? You know, if they need more money, why are they making so much money? So I don't necessarily agree with, even with legal gambling, that a professional athlete should be able to vote or bet on other sports. It's a weird gray area for me, and I don't really see a pathway to that being ethical. But it's a great conversation, and clearly we rushed through this thing so quickly, legalizing gambling in the United States, that we didn't consider some of these things. I mean, we were still living in the era where we thought it was a little absurd that some of these guys had fantasy teams for no money or for money amongst themselves, where it's like, you know, football players are talking to other football players about their fantasy team, or a known instance where a pitcher and a catcher having a mound visit regarding a fantasy football team. So it's a weird gray area. The Shohei thing, I think it is opening up a scab that never fully healed. And I hope that it kind of opens up the discussions to prevent this from happening, even on a legal standard.
We've seen it just recently in the NBA, right? With Michael Porter's brother in Toronto, the unders all hit, and DraftKings said it was the most betted thing on that game. And there's a whole, and we'll talk about that as the season comes to an end and that investigation continues to go forward. And I think for me, and I'll just leave it at this for the athletes themselves, right? Because there's always this conspiracy theory that's been going on forever, right? That every game is rigged. The NFL is scripted. This is not just a new Q2024 Zoomer thing in the internet. Like, there's always been rumors about all sports always being fixed. They've been saying that the NBA has been fixed since Patrick Ewing somehow ended with the Knicks. Like, we know.
Well, you know, conspiracy theories. Donaghy, the referee that was known to be. And we know about point shaving scandals. Here's the problem. Like, games can be fixed, but I don't think it's as conspiratorial as the entire team.
Yes.
They were missing shots. You know, it's usually like a couple of bad eggs or an off night or whatever, or, you know, or they know, hey man, if we score 101 tonight, that hits the over. All right, we'll keep it at 99, you know?
Yeah. Somebody's incentives. They do it for themselves for contracts. Like, hey, he needs X amount of rebounds today, so whatever you do, make sure you stay away from him when the – like, this is all part of it, but this is where I wanted to kind of bring it in finally, is the athlete themselves. Most of these athletes, men or women, no matter the professional sport, heck, even the collegiate and high school, are so competitive that it's hard for them to allow themselves to just dive a game, especially when there's so much money in these contracts. That's why we do have to look into, like you mentioned, just rushing into this, the addiction part of this, the thrill, the rush, what makes somebody who has a bajillion dollars want to bet $500,000 on Canelo? These are questions that we all have to talk about now, because it's part of our reality. And one day the Sports Cubicle may be brought to you by FanDuel, DraftKings, PointsBet, all these different places. So we have to be
trained.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's the to me, that's the big part of this, right? It's just to have an open conversation about sports gambling and it just being beyond Shohei Ohtani and the TMZ-ness of this. I think it's a fun conversation. I'm glad I was able to have it to you, Polly. But more importantly, we want to know what you think, the people listening to the Sports Cubicle. Let us know on Twitter at Sports Cubicle TV, wherever you get your favorite podcasts, at Sports from the Couch, the Sports Cubicle. And of course, leave a comment, subscribe to us on YouTube at the Sports Cubicle, and check us out on SoundCloud at WCPT 820. For the great Paul Shabari, I'm Mike Mercado.
Well, Paulacious, it's not a really good time to be a White Sox fan. There's not a lot of positives there. So I'm going to do what people in Chicago do best. Let's go back to the past, Paulacious. And there's a lot of people in the city of Chicago. They'll tell you that Wrigley Field is the most beautiful ballpark they've ever been to. It's so great here. And anyone over the age of 40 on the South Side might disagree with us. And that's why I can't think of anyone better than the author of the book Last Comiskey, Ken Smoller. So, Ken, thank you for joining us today.
Pleasure to be here. Pleasure to be here amongst Sox fans during these dark times.
The few, the proud, the brave. So, yeah. Ken, I believe around last year there was the documentary Last Comiskey, which you were not a part of, but you have the book that has the same title here. So I guess what is really your connection to Comiskey Park, the documentary, and the history that you left behind, that you have led with it?
Actually, I got to be a small part of the documentary. So Matt Flash, the documentarian, crowdsourced through social media, trying to get videos and photos for his documentary. And I, as I'll talk about in a little time, had taken hundreds and hundreds of photos of Old Comiskey Park during its last few years, especially during its last season. And so I contributed photos that he used for the transitions and for the movie poster. And after the film came out, people loved it, especially Sox fans, but baseball fans all across the country loved it. And I discussed with Matt, how can we turn this thing into a book? I've got all these photos that we didn't use, all these quotes and these great interviews that you conducted for the film would look great in a book with these photos. And last July, we agreed to turn it into a book, and it all came together this fall. And just love how it turned out. It's a great chance to share all my old photos that have been sitting there in boxes of negatives collecting dust with people who actually care to see them, White Sox fans and baseball fans and just fans of ballparks. It's great to share it, and love how the book turned out.
So back in 1990, when you were taking these photos, were you kind of already like an amateur photographer that was kind of had like a little bit of a shutter bug? And then
a little bit. Yeah. So I first started, the first time I ever took a picture was for Camera Day 1982. When they had the cool new uniforms and Bolazinski had just joined and Fisk. And I brought my little Kodak 110 camera for your older audience. And then I brought it in for a baseball, for a birthday message on the scoreboard when I was, I think, 10, 12 years old. But in college, I was at Michigan on the newspaper for the University of Michigan, the Michigan Daily. And I was a sports photographer, got to cover the Fab Five and Desmond Howard when he won the Heisman Trophy. But my passion was always Chicago sports, in particular the Sox and the Bears. And as I became a good, decent photographer, I wanted to capture as much of Old Comiskey as I could before it disappeared to the wrecking ball. I knew that someday these photos would be important. Someday these photos would be special to me and to hopefully my future kids. But I knew Sox fans would want to see them, and I wasn't sure if anyone else was doing it. So I took a couple days off my summer job when I was probably 19 years old. And brought my camera in tow to Comiskey and just walked all around the ballpark, inside, outside, the concourses, the bathrooms, everything. I was able to get one press pass by virtue of being a Michigan Daily photographer. There was a pitcher by the name of Jim Abbott who played for the Angels, a one-armed pitcher who was a real great guy and a real good pitcher. But because he was coming to visit the White Sox, I asked if I could get a press pass to interview him and photograph him. And a wonderful woman named Adele Powell, who was in charge of press passes at the time, hooked me up, gave me access to parts of Comiskey I never would have seen. I got to see the locker room, got to meet manager Jeff Torborg after a real bad loss in his clubhouse office and take a picture of him. It's included in the book. I got to find little nooks in the bullpen. I got to go talk to Jim Abbott in the bullpen and different aspects of the park that I had never seen. It was great. So I got to really share that or experience that and now share those photos well after the ballpark is gone. So it's a real, you know, bittersweet time looking back to those memories, but it's great to relive 1990 when 2024 doesn't seem like it's going to provide a lot of excitement for us.
And when you were following the team then, I mean, 1990 was kind of an unexpected season with some of the younger players and just how bad they were in 1989. Had they kind of hit their stride by this point when you were going to the ballpark?
Yeah, it was great. It was great. The crowds were full. You didn't know where the crowds there because it was the last season. You know, tourists were coming in, baseball fans from all around. But after a little while, it was because the team was good. They had an exciting young team. They had four draft picks in a row, number one draft picks that were all real successful players. You had Jack McDowell, Frank Thomas, Robin Ventura, and Alex Fernandez all came up one after another. They clicked with, you know, Carlton Fisk, who found the fountain of youth that year. I think he stole like 12 bases that season. Everyone came together. That pitching staff was fantastic and was really well set up for what would have been a playoff run had there just been a wild card. Because they unfortunately were going against the medically enhanced Oakland A's that were at the peak of their muscles. The one thing that gives a little bit of soothing memories for White Sox fans is that they ended up getting swept by the upstart Reds that year. But the A's just, they could not be caught by the White Sox. Every time the Sox got close, there would be a bad loss. Or the A's would string together a winning streak. Worse yet, they picked up Harold Baines, White Sox legend, at the trade deadline. That had salt in the wounds for Sox fans. But it was an exciting year. It felt like a pennant chase. You really, really felt like you were living with that team every day. And it kind of made you forget that you're about to lose your treasured family member in Comiskey Park.
What was your favorite part about Old Comiskey Park? Was it like the pole chain shower? Was it the arch windows? Like what was the thing that you looked forward to the most? The ball.
The arch windows are really special. If you look at any old baseball cards, you will often see they must have always been photographed in Chicago. They were there at Wrigley or Old Comiskey, and you see those arches in the background. But for me, it kind of comes down to a moment, which is when a home run was hit. Everything came together then. You had the scoreboard explode, and there was the original monster that Bill Veeck built in 60, but then the one that was replaced in 82 had some extra bells and whistles. Some weren't as loud. You had the fireworks go off. You had that noisy scoreboard. Then you had Nancy Faust playing Na 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 Na. You had all the fans. It could be 5,000 fans in September. It was loud. And you'd hear all the fans singing. You'd hear them all chanting with Na 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 Na. And that was the moment that really got me and made me a White Sox fan from, you know, the age of about 8 years old. I think the first time I ever went to a game was in 77. And I always cared more about the White Sox hitting a home run than winning in those days. They were never going to win a championship, I felt. But you could see a few cool home runs, cool fireworks. Better yet, if they were in the upper deck or the center field bullpen area. Those were really special moments as Sox fans. So it was more a feeling than anything else that captured all those different parts of Old Comiskey.
Ken, we talked about kind of the sights and the sounds of Old Comiskey. Give me the smells, though. Since you said you worked at the new ballpark, you've been to the new ballpark, you get this overwhelming smell of like grilled onions right when you walk in, you know, hot dogs, that sort of thing. Did the old ballpark have that sort of smell to it?
Much more. Like,
what was the smell?
Yeah. It's funny you say that, because I talk about at one point about the sights, sounds, and smells of the old park. So, you know, when you go to a party and it smells like there was maybe a lot of beer spilled the night before, think of 80 years of that. And, you know, Sox fans were always known, in particular in those days, it was always called the world's largest saloon, as being a much more hard-drinking crowd than the Wrigley crowd. Maybe it's changed in this day and age. But you'd always smell that beer.
There was a study recently that I think White Sox fans are the biggest beer drinkers in the whole league. So I think the moniker
certainly was my memory when I used to vend. But I remember that as a kid. What I would always do as a kid is I'd go, and my dad would be there. He'd probably be tired of me talking all the time about baseball, my baseball cards. But the drunk guy sitting next to me, whoever that may have been, he always loved talking to me. There was that smell. Another other smell was Bill Veeck had a requirement that there'd always be fresh popped popcorn so that you'd smell that movie theater kind of smell when you would walk in. The grilled onions, of course, are part of it. Listen, I've been to every major league ballpark. I've been to hundreds more ballparks. Nothing smells like those grilled onions of when you go into old or even new Comiskey Park. Maybe I'd give Old County Stadium a nod as having a pretty good smell as well. They did it right up there too. But that was something always special. The other thing that was, and we talked about the home runs before, you would smell that sulfur from the fireworks after they went off. Better yet, if you got back to back, the whole park would be filled with that sort of post-fireworks smell because the fireworks were done a little closer in those days. Originally, they were done from the scoreboard and then right behind. Now they're done on a platform, I think, about 100 feet away from the park, probably for safety reasons. But you don't get that smell the same way that you used to. I always remember that. The other thing is it always smells cigars. You don't get that anymore. So when you would get home from a ballpark, driving home, you would just stink, even if you weren't drinking, of stale beer, cigars, popcorn, onions, and hopefully some sulfur as well. But it really was a visceral feeling when you went to Old Comiskey. It just wasn't like how you feel today, where it feels like you're really kind of removed from the action, where you felt like you were part of it in the old ballpark.
So, Ken, you talked about how you – I'm sorry, Paul?
Oh, go ahead, Devin. Go on.
So, Ken, you were talking about how your dad got annoyed, but the drunk people had talked to you. Old Comiskey had a lot of celebrities. There was Sox Man. There was the Clown. Did you have – any interactions with these, I guess, old Comiskey Park celebrities?
You know, Andy the Clown was somewhat controversial. A lot of people liked him. And now, you know, a lot of people are also afraid of clowns, but he would get kind of annoying at times. He would do this very long extended, "Come on, you White Sox." And that was 1/20th of what he would do. And when the ballpark was kind of empty, it would echo around the place. And you would hear it everywhere. And there were definitely some Sox fans that didn't love it. There's a great story about it where he tried to, the ownership tried to get rid of him and he ended up getting a raise. Tom Scherer tells that story in the pod, in the documentary, and it comes up in the book as well. I ended up getting a nice photo of him at the last night game before the last day game at Old Comiskey. You know, you see all kinds of characters. There was a guy who was there shining shoes on the third base line right below where the concourse started. He was always there. You'd see the same guy, the guy with a real scratchy voice selling programs, who I couldn't understand how he could even possibly say it loud enough, given how scratchy his voice was. My dad used to always talk about, he'd see the same parking attendant in the left field parking lot that faced Dan Ryan. He'd always say, "That's the guy I remember when I was a kid." And those are the sort of generational things that you saw. When I spoke to Ozzie Guillen about doing the foreword for the book, he talked about he used to know everyone at the ballpark, and you just don't have the same interactions, even he as a player or manager at New Comiskey, because the way it's all set apart, the there's a sort of a working level below where the fans are at all the modern ballparks, and you go up before you really start where the stands are. And so you don't have that same kind of interaction. White Sox players used to have to walk through the concourse to get to their parking lot from the dugout, from the locker room. And that's not something that you would see today. The parking lot was right there on Fields Ave, or Bill Veeck Drive, as you would call it now. And you could see the players coming in. I've got a photo of Ozzie driving his Mercedes in and tossing the keys to the Andy Frayne usher. You'd see all those same guys everywhere, same guys and women. And of course, the you know, queen of them all was Nancy Faust, who sat right there in the stands, and you could go up there and talk to her, recommend songs. You know, there was a lot of different people that you felt like you got to know over the years. It just, it isn't the same at any new ballpark, especially at New Comiskey.
So you mentioned Ozzie Guillen did the foreword. Who were some of the other people that contributed to the book?
There are so many different people who were interviewed for the documentary, and then it carried forward to the book. Don Paul, who is pitched a handful of years for the White Sox, but most notably is a Sox fan. He grew up as a Sox fan from the suburbs, the South Suburbs. he contributed a lot. He also took a photo for me of a plaque that he got on the last day that I included in the book. He was in there. Ron Kittle was in there. Bobby Thigpen, who broke the save record that year that had been Dennis Eckersley's record, which had lasted, I think, another 18 years thereafter. All kinds of players. I think there were about 15 different players contributed quotes from that era. Ozzie Guillen, of course, the funniest and most profane of all of them, all of which is included in the book. I made sure that, you know, we were not going to sanitize the language that you would hear at Comiskey, but that is all there. Go ahead. Good.
Oh, I was going to say, and then the book's coming out April 28th, but tell us about how people can find the book. And then I think you mentioned about a party as well.
Yeah. Yeah. The book is available now for pre-sale at lastcomiskeybook.com. It is going to be released in early May, late April. We're just getting it printed right now. And then we're going to have a real big book launch event at the Chicago History Museum, a little bit in enemy territory. Don Paul has agreed to appear. We're trying to get two more players. I don't want to announce them quite yet because they haven't fully committed. Tom Scher, the old host, morning host on The Score, and WMAQ is going to be the MC. And we're trying to get Nancy Faust there in one way or another. She's injured now from a bad fall, but we're trying to get her there maybe to play, maybe just to appear. So they're going to all be there. We're hoping for a big crowd. The tickets are free. The book will be available, and some other White Sox and old Comiskey merch will be there. But it's a real great event. It's a terrific museum, which actually houses one of the old pinwheels from old Comiskey Park on the scoreboard that is in their exhibit, their permanent collection. So people should check that out other times. But lastcomiskeybook.com is where you can buy the book. Or you could check out my sports travel blog, which is stadiumvagabond.com. I've photographed over 2,300 stadiums throughout the world. And, Comiskey's the OG for me and my favorite one. But I've seen a lot of great ballparks all around the world. And it's something that I love to share with people.
Before you go, how long have you been doing Stadium Vagabond?
I've been doing it really in earnest since COVID began. I had been doing it previously, but I wasn't really taking it terribly seriously yet. People for decades have been saying, you got to do something with all these sports photographs. And I finally had time to do something. I was on a sports road trip in Alberta, Canada for hockey. And actually to see the great band Wilco, Chicago's own, in Calgary. And that's when COVID began. I got to see one hockey game and then everything got canceled. So me, who loves to travel to sporting events, had nowhere to go. So my wife suggested, why don't you finally do something with these photos? I started this blog and started writing these travel essays. My favorite one is about the Field of Dreams game, maybe our last happy memory as Sox fans, which I got to attend. But it was really, you know, when this Comiskey project started that I started to put in an overdrive and tie together my writing and my sports photography and my passion for these stadiums, you know, some lost, some that are still here that people love to talk about and see. You know, I don't always talk about sort of the X's and O's, but I love to talk about the experiences of what it was like to attend these games and share those with people. So it's really exciting having this book come out, and love sharing it with Sox fans, the ones that got to go to old Comiskey and the ones that never got to see it. And maybe someday soon we'll have a new ballpark that we can be proud of again. So hopefully I'm all in favor of the South Loop move. I just got to find someone to pay for it.
I'm fine with anything other than that stadium named Guaranteed Rate Field.
I don't call it that. I only refer to one of the corporate names in a quote once in the book. It is Sox Park or Comiskey Park in my mind. So Sox Park is a suitable alternative.
I like it much better than
Birdie. I'm a huge fan of the current ballpark, but I understand that it looks very generic. It has no character compared to the old
park. Ozzie talks about that a bit in the foreword. You know, when he first saw it, it was one of the new ones, but we didn't know yet what was to come down the line. And later, little did we know, the Sox could have had Camden Yards or something like it, but they wanted Royal Stadium. And that was kind of the gold standard at the time. And since then, the 12 parks built subsequently in the decade thereafter kind of makes Sox fans a little envious to what could have been. They've done a great job of updating it a little bit. to make it feel slightly more intimate, but it's not on par. And I'd love to see that South Loop ballpark come to fruition.
Where are you located?
I live in Brookline, Mass. So I'm two miles from Fenway. I walked to opening day yesterday.
Very cool.
I didn't get a chance to share. This is a topic I'm going to talk about in my second book, which is going to be all the Chicago stadiums. I got so many great ones of Old Soldier Field and of Chicago Stadium, but it was the coolest thing when the Sox finally won their first ever playoff series in 05. I got to go to that, sat with my wife, who's a Red Sox fan, in the bleachers. And then when the ALDS ended and we won, the players came out and celebrated with us. They poured champagne on all the fans. I've got this great shot of Uribe spraying champagne at me. It was just the coolest experience. And then we went down the street. The hotel where they hatched the Black Sox scandal was the Hotel Buckminster, where, you know, the White Sox would stay in 1919. New York Gamblers came up, met with Chick Gandel. They hatched the whole plan there. So after that game, when we won, there was a Chicago Unas franchise, not the real thing, but whatever. So I went to go celebrate and have some fake deep dish pizza and some sort of Chicago beer celebrate, I think a goose. You know, the fact that we've gone full circle, we've erased the Shoeless Joe. So I'm going to talk a lot about that in my second book.
Well, while I have you for a second, what was the stadium like when El Duque got all three of those outs?
Holy shit, was that amazing. I don't think my heart has ever beat it that fast. I've got a photo of him kind of hopping off the field. I also have a photo of him in the bullpen warming up as I was sitting in the bleachers. Man, that was great. You know, the Red Sox fans were okay because they'd already won. They won the year before. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they didn't care as much, but it was special. There were about 1,000 White Sox fans that were there, and we all congregated around the dugout, and it was just so cool. I had a shirt that became my good luck shirt through the playoffs that Uribe sprayed champagne on. I ended up going to game one and four of the World Series. So wore that all throughout. Mark Burley sprayed me with champagne after the championship. So, you know, there are some good memories, but man, if they'd only won it at Old Comiskey, it would have been special. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't get a chance to talk about this. I learned this in my research. There's only one team that ever won a championship at Old Comiskey, the Chicago Cardinals in 47.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow.
The Sting didn't win. Chicago Sting didn't win. The Negro League American Giants didn't win. The Sox won on the road in 1917. And in 06, when they beat the Cubs, it was at their old ballpark, the Southside Grounds. So that corner has not been successful.
The Sting didn't win in 81 or 84 when they were there?
Toronto. They won in a neutral territory in Toronto.
I got
once at a racetrack they were playing for some reason. I think once at Exhibition Stadium. But they won on the road. No one ever won at Old Comiskey. I never realized that, except for the Chicago Cardinals.
Crazy. So, that is a key fact right there.
Yeah, it was a really cool thing. I thought I knew everything about the old ballpark, but that came up during my research. So,
well, there you hear it. Ken Smoller, the author of Last Comiskey. The book comes out later in April, early May, lastcomiskeybook.com. Ken, thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to have you back again.
Thanks for having me. Love to be back. Good to talk to you guys. Let's hope for the players to get healthy.
Yes, hey, go Sox.
We continue on the Sports Cubicle. If you remember, about a month or two ago, we found out that due to the construction of Ryan Field, the Northwestern University football team would not have a home in the upcoming season. Now, it was said that they had not committed to any venue, but they did announce this week that they will be playing on their own home surface on the lake, where the lacrosse team, the soccer teams play, the Lanny and Martin Stadium, if I'm pronouncing that right. And they're going to do a temporary sort of thing. They haven't released any designs. They haven't really told us much about that. And they also play 7 home games this year. So it's going to be quite a logistical challenge. And they have mentioned that they might look into other local Chicago venues as well. We're going to get right into it. And of course, I brought on the marvelous one, Dan Marver. He knows our college stuff. He knows our local college stuff. And I think he's going to like this Northwestern home schedule for this upcoming season. And, you know, Marver, what do you think about just one plane on the campus, which is probably going to be, you know, what they're saying is a very low capacity compared to what Ryan Field offers. But just as a makeshift venue, what are your thoughts?
I think it will work for the non-conference season, Miami O and Eastern Illinois. But I think they'll probably want to look at maybe, you know, Soldier Field or Wrigley Field or what have you for the Big Ten games where the road crowd outdraws the home crowd usually. I mean, I wouldn't want those Ohio State fans to be disappointed if they can't get a seat. But I'm just trying to figure out what the configuration would be. There's not a whole lot of space. And if they put bleachers on, I can't imagine. I mean, just trying to imagine 20,000 bleachers or more. It just, I mean, it seems like a logistical nightmare. But and then again, here, the other thing will be, they imagine that the TV people and in a few night games too, another factor that, you know, that could be challenging. But you know, it seems odd to me in a way that, knowing so far in advance that this was going to happen, I would have expected that there would have been a plan, you know, in place, you know, knowing that they weren't going to have a home in 2024 and 2025. And, you know, they right now, for example, Soldier Field, their home opener is scheduled August 31st. And there's a soccer game that day. And I actually, having been a graduate of Miami O, I noticed on their schedule, they said they might play the game on Sunday. Because you know, the building's being used, Soldier Field, that is, on Saturday. So we'll see what happens there. I'm trying to figure, once I see what the design is for the seating, I'll be able to have a better opinion upon whether they will work, because, you know, they do have a full Big Ten schedule. And I don't know what the rules are about the Big Ten, and, you know, whether they, you know, have some jurisdiction about how many seats there must be, because I know that in some conferences they do have that, but they could make an exception for the 1 year and whatnot. But you know, so I think it's, to play on campus would be wonderful. It's just that there isn't enough information yet to see if it's if it makes sense, because if you look at the design, I mean, of where the actual soccer lacrosse field is, there is some space, but I'm just trying to visualize it, and I can't put it in my head yet as to how that's going to look. But you know, on campus would be ideal, obviously.
It's such a beautiful backdrop too, with the lakefront right behind it. But of course, we don't know what it looks like. And I think you brought up every one of the points that I wanted to bring up. You know, what does the conference feel about this? You know, I think what do the television people think about this? You know, it makes me think of the English Premier League and them with broadcasting. Luton Town got promoted so quickly through all the ranks that their stadium was so small that there had to be a delay to their first home game of the season because of all the ways they had to fit the right camera towers and places to put people. And I'm wondering if the same thing is going to happen. You know, I know it's a little bit of a different situation with Northwestern, but with it being such a small makeshift venue, what sort of challenges are they going to even have broadcasting from there? But when I look at the schedule, though, I think you're right about the games where they're going to be played. You know, Wisconsin comes in October. Ohio State comes in November. We don't know what the Bears' schedule looks like yet, but, you know, having Wisconsin and Ohio State in Chicago, you got to play at the larger venue. And then, of course, you know, University of Illinois at the end, do the traditional game at Wrigley Field. So, you know, I'm hoping that those venues are able to accommodate that. I know Guaranteed Rate Field has been mentioned as well. You know, and I know that, you know, they could probably do a destination game maybe somewhere neutral site in between some of these schools if really, you know, if truly needed, you know, if a DeKalb was something that they do in between Wisconsin or, you know, what have you. But I think it's just a really interesting time. And you know, you wouldn't think in this day and age that there would be a power conference team, especially in an expanded power conference, playing in such a small venue. But of course, this is a temporary solution, and there's a long-term plan at Ryan Field that's hopefully going to last them for quite a while. But before we wrap up here, Marver, I wanted to just briefly talk about some of the bigger stories, you know, of this weekend as well. You know, the Arizona Coyotes, we've known about them with venue problems and just a basic lack of interest in the desert for that hockey club. And it was announced this week, I don't think officially, but some serious reports and some you know, viable sources that are saying that the Arizona Coyotes are going to be looking into Salt Lake City. And as recently as this week, They'll be checking it out. And I guess that's, it was bound to happen that the Coyotes were going to leave Arizona, but Salt Lake City was not the first city I thought of as a new destination for NHL hockey.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, it's obviously money talks. The Jazz owner is the one that's going to be behind the purchase, supposedly. And, you look at some of these teams that are in certain cities. I mean, speaking of a smaller venue, they've been playing at the Arizona State University Hockey Arena, which is very small by NHL standards. So therefore, they can't get a new arena, apparently, and that's part of the problem. But the funny thing is that, you know, they came from Winnipeg originally, which is definitely more of a hockey hotbed than Arizona. So some of these moves, I mean, one that shocked me the most going back is Minnesota, that draws full houses for high school games, moved to Dallas at one point. So, I mean, some of these moves are kind of interesting, and a lot of it's about money, like I said. But the move to Salt Lake City, I mean, it's a Utah, you know, it seems they're probably going to support hockey, and it's a move. But I also read in the article that they want to be guaranteed an expansion team. Arizona does, and since they hardly supported this team, I don't know that the NHL would be too excited about guaranteeing them another team someday. But that seems to be on the table. But it's been a bad situation for them in Arizona, and it seems like this is a good solution for that situation. There's, like you say, there's a lot of cities that don't have NHL, and out west, if it stays out west, this is probably about the best choice. I mean, they have local rivalries of Vegas, and they'll have, you know, Seattle. So, I mean, it seems like it's a pretty decent move all the way around, and the best solution to a bad situation.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Winnipeg having the team that, you know, originally before they moved to Arizona, and then the fact that another failed, you know, major metropolitan area that couldn't carry a hockey team ended up filling that spot back in Winnipeg, and that was Atlanta. So, I guess that to me, that looks like a stain on the record of, you know, Gary Bettman, who already doesn't have the best reputation as a commissioner for the NHL, to have two major metropolitan areas fail to carry the hockey teams that were there. I know Arizona had a way longer tenure than Atlanta, but, I'd be curious to see if those two cities get a team anytime soon before, let's say, Quebec or Milwaukee or, you know, a different, you know, city like that. I don't know if Kansas City would be an option or any place like that, but I just figure that there's got to be other markets aside from, you know, Salt Lake City or Phoenix that could carry a team. But does the NHL even need to expand? I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
I can remember there being six teams, you know.
Yeah.
You know, the
original six,
way
yeah.
Back when, you know, Toronto, Montreal, Detroit, Boston, Chicago, New York. It's a, you know, I had a little toy game where they had those six teams and the little hockey game. But now it's really out of control. I mean, I couldn't believe it when you got the teams in the South. I mean, it just seemed like a logical sport for the North. You know, there isn't too much other than artificial ice in Florida, you know, or Texas or California. So those were, you know, some places that I guess I'm told that in Florida they have a lot of people from Montreal that support the team that plays in the Panthers, Florida Panthers, and the Tampa Bay Lightning and whatnot. But there's too many teams to me. It used to be you'd have a rivalry, you'd play, you know, used to be Sunday games always at the Chicago Stadium, and you'd play New York on Saturday, and then you'd have them at home on Sunday. Boston the same, Montreal the same, Toronto is, you knew all the players, and now that isn't the case. It's so spread out, and like in most sports, you hardly see some of the teams coming in. You know, even like baseball now with the full interleague play, it's like you don't really get to see the players come into your city very often, and besides the fact that it's $1 million to go see the games, you know, it's quite a bit different. And I'd almost like to see them contract rather than expand personally, but I don't see them adding Phoenix anytime soon as an expansion team.
Well, final thoughts. The Masters are this weekend. You got any thoughts on who's going to win? It looks like Scottie Scheffler's up by a couple strokes, but he's just starting his day as we record this.
Yeah, well, it was a good story to have Tiger Woods in his 24th qualification in a row to break the record, but then he blew up with an 82 yesterday, so that story went away. And Scheffler, it looks like he's solid. I mean, it's still some time as we're speaking, but it looks like he could possibly hang in there. I mean, he's still got a lot of holes to play as we're speaking, but he's a good finisher, so he may hang in there and get another green jacket.
We keep things rolling here on the Sports Cubicle. I'm your host, Mike Mercado, and this story hitting the news wire, O.J. Simpson has passed away. This comes to us from ESPN. O.J. Simpson dies of cancer, age 76, family says. O.J. Simpson, the decorated football superstar and Hollywood actor who was acquitted of charges he killed his former wife and her friend, but later was found liable in a separate civil trial, has died. He was 76. The family announced on Simpson's official X account that Simpson died Wednesday after battling prostate cancer. He died in Las Vegas, officials there said Thursday. Quote, on April 10th, our father, Ortho Simpson, succumbed to his battle with cancer. He was surrounded by his children and grandchildren. During this time of transition, his family asked that you please respect their wishes for privacy and grace, the family posted on Simpson's X account. And the article continues, Simpson earned fame, fortune, and adulation through football and show business, but his legacy was forever changed by the June 1994 knife slayings of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ronald Goldman, in Los Angeles. On June 12th, the bodies of Brown Simpson and Goldman were found outside her condo in the Brentwood area of Los Angeles. Simpson was a person of interest in the murders, but rather than turn himself in 5 days later, he led police on a low-speed chase throughout Los Angeles as a passenger in a white Ford Bronco driven by former NFL player Al Cowlings. An estimated television audience of 95 million watched the drama unfold, with live coverage interrupting regular programming, including the NBA Finals. And lastly of this article, I also want to mention this part. Simpson gained widespread popularity across society as the Heisman Trophy-winning tailback for the University of Southern California in the late 1960s. As a rental car ad pitchman rushing through airports in the late 1970s, and as a commentator for Monday Night Football, and an actor in movies such as the Naked Gun series in the 1980s. The public was mesmerized by his Trial of the Century on live TV. It featured lead prosecutor Clark against the legal dream team for Simpson led by Johnny Cochran, who famously pleaded to the jury during closing arguments, "If it doesn't fit, you must acquit." A reference to a glove matching one found at the scene of the murders. His case sparked debates on race, gender, domestic abuse, celebrity justice, and police misconduct. So that is the jumping off point I want to use, is how complicated this story was for a lot of people. This day, this news. I think most sports fans, I think most people who heard this news, who knows who O.J. Simpson is, felt some type of way of shock, some type of moment in time where it just stopped for a second and like, wow, that happened. O.J. Simpson died. And he was diagnosed, or there was the rumors of him being diagnosed with prostate cancer and him even being in hospice. And he goes on his Twitter account, his X account, and says those are all just rumors. And obviously we know how it all ended for O.J. I think the thing we have to keep in mind, there are so many different conversations when you're talking about O.J. Simpson. There's the conversation about the great football player. There's the conversation about the actor. There's the conversation of the impact he has made in our pop culture. There's the impact he has made being accused and tried and acquitted of murdering two people and then being found liable in civil court. Then going to jail for holding people hostage and trying to get his memorabilia back and all the craziness that that story was. And the If I Did It book and the music videos. And all the weird interviews, all that are conversations that are part of this huge story. But it's also important to bring up the race issue of what it meant in the 90s to during the Rodney King stuff and seeing people of color, brown people, black people, poor white people being mistreated and not getting their fair due in the justice system. These were all facts. These are all things that can live simultaneously, and also acknowledging that two people were horrifically murdered. Yes, I know it's complicated, and I know it's really easy to plant your flag down in one side of an argument, to make things as easy as just one statement. But the fact remains is all these things can be true, where people of color, poor people, are mistreated by the justice system and don't always get the same opportunity people with wealth have. We can also talk about how it is easy to target celebrities, while also saying it's easy for celebrities to buy themselves out of trouble. We can also talk about how O.J. Simpson was acquitted of murder, but all the circumstantial evidence leans one way. You can be excited if you're a person of color, somebody who feels the mistreatment of average citizens of the judicial system that somebody quote-unquote got over on them, but that doesn't take away that a family, two families, are heartbroken, have never been the same decades later. The thing that sickened me about this entire conversation, that so many people wanted to make it as simple as bad guy, good guy. You can have your opinion about O.J. Simpson. I do. I don't make it a secret. But I also understand the nuance of this conversation, especially when you're talking to people from different age groups, different demographics. O.J. Simpson means a lot of things to a lot of different people. And I just wanted to make sure that we kind of touched all the bases of that. That there are people that absolutely think he's the devil. There are some people that believe he's the virtual signal of a corrupt justice system that got its just desserts. And then there's everybody in the middle that has their opinions, understands the nuance, and also understands that life's not fair and things just happen. Obviously, we had to talk about this story. One of the greatest football players of all time, one of the biggest athletes to hit the airwaves and cross the genre of sports into pop culture, into celebrity. And even if you look at all the controversies besides the ones that we really talk about, the identity crisis that OJ had to go through, being such a prominent black man in America, having to conform to what he was living through as a major star in the NFL and in Hollywood. And then the way OJ then interacted with the black community post all that success after the trial. There's so much to this story, but it's a complicated person, complicated story. And while I've said it, I think he did it. I don't even feel it's that crazy of a thing to say, right? Like, most people, I think, believe that. But I'm also aware that this conversation, this story, this time in history means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. O.J. Simpson dies of cancer at the age of 76. Let us know your thoughts about this entire story. How old were you during the Bronco chase? How old were you when this trial was going on? Have you watched all the documentaries? Are you just now going down the rabbit hole of O.J. Simpson? Let us know your thoughts. We're on Twitter at SportsCubicleTV. Of course, check us out wherever you get your favorite podcasts. We're on all podcast platforms at Sports From The Couch, The Sports Cubicle, and subscribe to us on YouTube at youtube.com/The Sports Cubicle. We have more coming up next here on The Sports Cubicle. I'm Mike Mercado.
Well, that's going to do it for this week's edition of The Sports Cubicle. I want to thank you all for listening. For Devin Tingle, Mike Mercado, and the marvelous one, Dan Marver, I am Paul Shavari. We are The Sports Cubicle. We're on WCPT 820. You can find our podcasts, soundcloud.com/WCPT 820, where we have every single episode up there for you. We're also on YouTube. You can find a lot of our segments just by searching at The Sports Cubicle. We're also on X or Twitter or whatever they're calling it these days, at Sports Cubicle TV. Feel free to reach out to us. Let us know what you think about what we've been talking about, and like and subscribe. So long, everybody, and we will see you next week.